What's so funny? Hashtag, oh yeah. My response is silence to that. I'm silently judging you, Brian Lucas. Feel my silent judgment by not bringing it up. I'm learning. I really am. As you can tell from what Alan just read, we're continuing our series in the life and ministry of Jesus, and you may have thought that we were done at Easter, but we're actually going to take this series through May. And what we're going to do the next month is look at some post-resurrection accounts of Jesus and what we learn about Jesus through how he appears to his disciples and others after his resurrection. And should have had these last week, but outside, just want to make these known to you, out at brunch, out at the table out there, we have these little, they're called Alive, a cold case approach to the resurrection. Some of you remember J. Warner Wallace was here a little while ago. He's a cold case detective, and he basically takes the skills that he's learned as a cold case detective and looks at the cold case of what happened to Jesus in his death and resurrection and gives great evidence that we can trust that this is reliable. So these are out here. If you want one, take one for yourself, or if you want to take one for a friend, just want to make you know about these. So, great story today, yeah, the road to Emmaus. One of my personal favorites. I think it's just a funny story. It's a wonderful story, a story of kind of sneaky Jesus, is what I call him in this passage. I love that. I want you to think for a second, if you had a word or phrase to describe what this story is about. Okay, you got a word or a phrase. What is the point? What is the theme of this story? What would it be for you? Take a second. You got a word or phrase. What is this story about? All right, on the count of three, we're going to say it, okay? One, two, three. Revelation. Okay? Good. Very good. No, I choose revelation. The Greek word for revelation is the word where we get our word apocalypse. And the word means that something that was hidden is uncovered, okay? So you picture like there's something behind a curtain, and you can't see it, it's hidden, and then apocalypse happens, and the curtain is pulled back, and something is revealed. And I say that because I think that, in a word, is what this passage is about. It's about the risen Christ revealing himself, lifting back the curtain to these two disciples. And so it begins in verse 16. Look at verse 16, it says, they were kept from recognizing him. So they're actually walking with the risen Christ, but there's some veil over their eyes, they can't see him. And the key word in the passage, at least by my reading, is a word that appears in verse 31 and 32. Take a look at it. It shows up twice. What is the word, do you think, that I'm looking for? Could be recognized, that would work. This one shows up twice. Opened is the word I'm looking for. Yeah. They couldn't see him, and then what he does is he opens the revelation of himself to them. First, it says in verse 31, he opened their eyes and they recognized him, and then they think back to what he did in the scriptures and how he opened the scriptures to them. So that's what this passage is about, this great passage of Jesus revealing himself, opening their eyes to who he is, and how he does that is part of the fun of the story, I think. And so today, the theme is really revelation. It's for us to see the risen Christ revealed. For us to fix our eyes on Jesus, to behold him through his word, through communion, which we'll be celebrating, and certainly through this story. And I was just thinking of that theme of our eyes being open and of seeing Jesus. That's really, I think, a real common scriptural theme. I want to give you a couple verses before we jump into the passage. I love this passage from 2 Corinthians 4. For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Okay? It's a picture of the God who created the universe. At the beginning, there was darkness, then he said, let there be light. And he shined light into the darkness. That same God, when we become believers, he does that same revelation in our hearts so that he shines light in our hearts so that we see his glory, his magnificence, his splendor, and we see it specifically in the face of Christ. When we look at the person of Christ in the Gospels, we see the glory of God on display, revealed to us. We see God's wisdom, we see God's love, God's joy, God's compassion. God's glory is made known to us in the face of Jesus Christ. God reveals himself through Jesus Christ. And so one of the most important biblical commands is this really well-known one in Hebrews 12. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down on the right hand of the throne of God. Okay, that's one of our fundamental calls as Christians. Let's fix our eyes on Jesus. Let Jesus' glory be revealed to us, that we are fixing our eyes and we're focusing on him every day of our lives. And I just want to talk you through a process that I'm going through personally in the last couple months. So last couple months, just on, not circumstantially, but just my own journey, have been somewhat, I think discouraging is too strong of a word, but I'm recognizing stuff in myself. And what's happening is, basically, I'm being confronted with my sin. And I have my, you know, my sins of choice that I go with. They're usually some combo of, I'm seeing a real self-centeredness. Excuse me, I'm losing this. I'm seeing my self-centeredness, just how much I focus on myself, my needs, my stuff, and how that prevents me from, like, looking out and loving people. My anxiety, my insecurities, my fears are surfacing. I'm seeing them more clearly. My love of comfort and a comfortable life, I'm seeing more clearly. And it's not like they're actually acting up more. What happened was, like, 3 months ago, I made a more intentional effort to try to fight them. And I started putting things in place in my life, prayers that I was praying, and just postures that I wanted to have throughout the day. So I started fighting this a little bit harder, and it's not like they've gotten worse, it's just I realized as I'm starting to fight against them, I'm realizing how deep these things actually go in my life. And so it's just a recognition of, okay, this is reality, this is who I am. In a lot of ways, it's felt like I'm trying to work at these things, and it's not working. That's kind of what it feels like. So there's a soberness to that. I'm not discouraged, but there's a soberness to it. But what's been coming up for me in various ways through the Word, through conversation, is I feel like God is responding to me in this, basically saying, Dave, you know what? Maybe you should stop trying to fix yourself. Stop trying to fix yourself. Start fixing your eyes on me. That's what I want you to do. Fix your eyes on me. And for me, there's something that feels almost too simple about that. Like that, there's got to be, that can't be the solution to the problem. Just focus on me. Keep fixing your eyes on me. And it feels a little too simple. And yet, at the same time, I realize that's really hard to do. I mean, to sustain focus on God on a day-to-day basis so that I'm considering who he is and what he's done for me and how great he is and how he's in control of my life, that's hard to do. And it's a simple thing, but it's not easy. And yet I think that's the call for us, to fix our eyes on Jesus. And what I was thinking about this week is the connection that the Bible makes between fixing our eyes on Jesus and how that actually can transform us. The simple act of focusing on him itself begins to change us. I was thinking this week of the story of Moses. Remember when Moses goes up the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments? And he is there and he's beholding God's glory. He's meeting with God and he's like in the presence of God's glory. And you remember what happens as he's coming down the mountain? Remember it's like he's been fixing his eyes on the Lord and it's almost like he's absorbed some of that glory. I think of like when I was younger, you had like those glow-in-the-dark balls, you know, that you could put by a lamp for a while and then it would absorb the light and then it would kind of stay lit for a while and it'd fade. But that's basically what happens to Moses is he fixes his eyes. He's in the presence of the Lord and being in God's presence and fixing his eyes on God's glory begins itself to change him and transform him into that glorious presence. This is what Paul says in 2 Corinthians. Look at this. He says, that's what it's like for us and Jesus as New Testament Christians. We all, with unveiled face, that's a reference to how Moses had to put a veil on his face because it was so bright. We all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. Understand that? Saying, as we look at Jesus and behold his glory, the Spirit works in our hearts. He begins to transform us into the thing, into the person that we're looking at. This is how John says it. Dear friends, now we are children of God in this age, and what we will be in eternity has not yet been made known. But we do know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he truly is. There's this connection between truly seeing Jesus and ultimately becoming like him. Everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. And so one of the best things we can do if we are looking to change our lives and be transformed is to simply fix our eyes on Jesus. And as we do that, the Spirit begins to change us into the person that we are looking at. This is how how the author of Hebrews ends this. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, and then look what he says. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Do you want to have strong hearts? Do you want to not grow weary? Fix your eyes on Jesus. As you do that, that will help you to become like the person you're looking at. Okay? So, kind of my own journey that I'm going through. And really, that's why we're doing this series. You know, we've been 4 months now into the series on Jesus. Why are we doing this? Because we're called to fix our eyes on Jesus. And hopefully, as we have considered him and fixed our eyes on him, the Spirit is slowly, gradually changing us to become more and more like the person that we are fixing our eyes on. And certainly, that is the goal for today. That's certainly the point of this passage, that Jesus reveals himself. He opens his eyes to these disciples. And my prayer is that he would open our eyes to himself in some fresh way. And what he does, you see this progressive revelation in this passage. He reveals himself through the word, and he opens their hearts to the scriptures. And then he reveals himself ultimately through the breaking of bread. So what we're going to do this morning is I'm going to walk pretty quickly through the passage. And then we're going to fix our eyes on Jesus through thinking, considering him through the word, and then considering him through the breaking of bread. And we'll celebrate communion and close. You guys up for that? Yeah? Okay. Good. Hashtag Dave's doing a great job. Okay. All right. So let's walk through this passage. And I want us to see the progressive revelation that takes place for these two disciples. Verse 13, let's start at the beginning. Now that same day, two of them were going to the village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. Okay, that same day is referring to the day of Jesus' resurrection that Luke just recorded in the first 12 verses. So this is the afternoon of his resurrection. The only thing is these two guys don't realize he's been raised yet. And I want you to put yourself in their shoes for a second, okay? Think of what they've been through over the last 3 years, and particularly over the last week, okay? What they're experiencing on this road to Emmaus, we don't know why they're going there, but what they're experiencing, in a word, is loss, right? I mean, they are experiencing loss. They are experiencing the loss of the most important person in their lives. They'd followed Jesus around probably for about 3 years, and he's the most compelling person they'd ever met. So full of joy and does miracles and amazing wisdom, amazing teaching. And they'd really given their lives over to this guy. And he'd become everything to them. And then just a couple days earlier, he'd been arrested, he'd been tried, and he'd been crucified, and he died. And so these two disciples are now sitting with the loss of the most important person in their life. And those of you who have lost someone really important, you know what that's like. You know what that experience of loss and grief is, and they're still totally shell-shocked by that. And they're also, I think, experiencing the loss of a dream, aren't they? I mean, they had a dream. It wasn't just a person, but there was a dream behind this person, that he was going to be the Messiah, and he was going to come in, and he was going to set up his kingdom in Jerusalem. And these guys got on board with that dream, and they left whatever they were doing, their occupations, and they just dove into this dream. They gave everything up to pursue this dream. And then in the end, this dream, this hope just comes crashing down in, you know, just brutal fashion. And so they're stuck thinking, how do we pick up the pieces of our lives? I mean, where do we go from here? And any of you who have really pursued a dream that hasn't worked out, you know that feeling. Whether it was a relationship that you went for and you poured yourself into and it didn't work out. Or maybe it was a career path that you went down for years and then it just kind of got cut off on you. You know that experience. So they're experiencing this deep loss And they're talking about, they're processing together on the road. As it said, verse 14, they're talking about it. And look at the end of verse 17. They stood still, their faces downcast. Okay, so you got these guys who are just bummed. We can use that word. And yet, there's this little ray of hope, because earlier that morning they heard from the women. Look back at verse 9. The women had seen the angel at the tomb, and when they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others. So these disciples would be part of all the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. Look at verse 11. But they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Okay? So they've heard the truth, and yet they can't believe it. It doesn't make any sense. But there is this little question in their mind. There's this ray of hope. And so that's where they find themselves on the road. And Jesus shows up in verse 15 as they talked and discussed these things with each other. Sneaky Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. I love this, but they were kept from recognizing him. Hard to say why they were kept. Maybe it was their lack of faith, their doubt that kept them. I kind of assume Jesus himself keeps them from recognizing him because he wants to take them through a little journey on the road to Emmaus. And so the fun of the passage is, of course, we, the reader, know more than the people in the story. And so that creates some fun little ironic moments like this. Verse 17, Jesus says, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" He pretends he doesn't know. They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you only a visitor to Jerusalem and do not know the things that have happened there in these last days?" Love that dynamic. He's like, you must be the only person in Jerusalem who's out of the loop here, right? Reality is, he's the only person in Jerusalem who is in the loop. They're completely out of the loop. They just don't know it yet. That's part of the fun of the story. He says, what things? Verse 19, about Jesus of Nazareth. Listen to this description of these two disciples. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. So after his death, what category are his disciples putting him in? Prophet, right? Interesting. And that makes sense. They spent 3 years with him. They've seen the miracles. They've heard the teaching. And yet his career ends disastrously on a cross. And so they have to, where do we fit this guy? And they've at least in this moment decided, prophet. He's a great man of God. God's spirit worked in him. We had hoped he was more than a prophet. We had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. We had hoped he was the Messiah. Obviously he wasn't because he's dead. But he was a great prophet. That's what they've concluded. And then they talk about how the women have come and told them about this and how they're not sure what to think about this. And then verse 25, this is where it starts to get, he starts to reveal things to them, but not yet himself. He said to them, "How foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" Their answer, did not the Christ? No. The Christ did not have to suffer. That's what they thought. But Jesus says, did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. I would have loved to have been a part of that conversation. Wouldn't that have been great? To have the author of the scriptures that all point to him walk you through, beginning with Moses, that is to say Genesis, all the way through, and explain the scriptures and specifically how they pointed to him. And my guess is, we don't know what texts he used. There's so many messianic texts, and I'm assuming he focused on the ones that talk about how the Messiah had to suffer. And what I want to do in a couple minutes, I want to walk us through some passages that he may have drawn on. We just don't know. But I just love that. But he doesn't yet reveal himself, even after that. After this great explication of scriptures, he still hasn't opened their eyes to himself. Verse 28, as they approached the village to which they were going, sneaky Jesus acted as if he were going farther. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening." This is good first century hospitality. "The day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it and began to give it to them. Interesting that somehow he's become the host at this meal. So I'm not sure how that happened, but maybe it was his explication of scriptures. Is that a word, explication? Yeah? Okay, I'll go with it. Explanation. Something they've seen this guy, there's an authority to this guy, and somehow he is now the host of this meal, and he breaks the bread. And verse 31, then their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And then sneaky Jesus disappears from their sight right away. I love this. So he takes them through the scriptures. Verse 32, it says, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road? Their hearts were kindled as he explains the scriptures to them. And yet, it's in that moment of breaking the bread that he finally reveals himself to them. And if you know Luke's gospel, you know that breaking bread is a common theme. This theme of sharing table fellowship together, sharing a meal is an expression of intimacy and hospitality. So it's in that moment of friendship around a table that Jesus reveals himself. And I think we're probably meant to think back to the last time he broke bread with them, which was at the Last Supper, when he broke this bread and said, "This is my body that's broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." I want to show you, there's almost like a perfect verbal parallel between this verse and that. This is our passage. He took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. And then this is Luke 22. He took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." So I think as they recognize the parallels, that is when he reveals himself, and then they disappear. And then they go back to the disciples in verse 33 and they swap stories because Jesus has appeared to Peter as well. Okay? So there's the passage, this progressive revelation of Jesus to these disciples. Sneaky Jesus, as I like to call him. I love the Jesus we see. He shows up, he walks, and he pretends that he doesn't know what they're talking about. And then he happens to have this amazing knowledge of the scriptures, and then he pretends that he's going to go on to the next village. And then the minute he reveals himself, he disappears. And I like that. We get another side of Jesus. We've gotten joyful Jesus and gracious Jesus and compassionate Jesus, even demanding Jesus. And here we get sneaky Jesus. And I love picturing him. I was thinking about this week. In the tomb on Sunday morning, with his resurrection body, before he walks out of the tomb, what is he, I mean, we don't know, but what is he, I just picture this joy and this almost childlike playfulness that's just going to emerge out of this tomb and begin revealing himself in ways. And it's interesting even who he reveals himself to. He doesn't go straight to the 12. He starts with the women, and then he goes to these two guys, and eventually he gets in closer to the kind of the core circle of the people that we see in the Gospels. And he does it in this somewhat sneaky way that builds suspense. But I just picture this childlike, joyful, resurrected Christ beginning to reveal himself to his followers. And it's just a beautiful thing. And notice how, just to close off this part of it, notice how the revelation of Jesus changes everything, right? I mean, you've got in verse 17, they start with their faces downcast, they're standing still, and by the end, they're back in Jerusalem, swapping stories with the disciples and full of excitement and joy. So you have Jesus in this passage revealing himself through his word, through the scriptures, and then through the breaking of bread. So that's what we're going to do this morning to close this off. I'm only about two-thirds of the way done, just so you know. But we're going to spend time fixing our eyes on Jesus. And we're going to do that first through his word, through thinking of the Old Testament scriptures that point to him. And then secondly, we'll close by seeing Jesus through the breaking of bread and the wine through communion. Okay? So what I want to do right now is first consider Jesus. Let's fix our eyes on Jesus through hearing his word, the Old Testament scriptures that point to his glory and point to the fact of his suffering, that are prophecies of his suffering. I want to suggest some passages that Jesus may have taken these two disciples to. We don't know, but here are some suggestions. You could add your own suggestions. I won't allow you to do that, but you could. Beginning with Moses and all the prophets. So let's go back to the beginning. I want to look at five passages. We'll move through them pretty quickly. that point to Jesus Christ, okay? You're going to need your Bibles for this, or your phones, your hashtag things. Let's go all the way back to the beginning, to Genesis chapter 3. This is, church tradition would say, written by Moses, which Jesus says beginning with Moses. Again, here's the goal. Let's fix our eyes on Jesus this morning together, okay? Let's behold his glory. Genesis chapter 3. You may not think of going back here to find a prophecy about Christ, but it's here. Chapter 3, verse 14. The context is, of course, God creates this beautiful garden. He creates Adam and Eve, and then they choose independence over him, and they have sinned. And God comes to them now, and the serpent, you got this enemy, the serpent that obviously tempts them. And God comes now and pronounces judgment on these three people because of what they've done. And he starts with the serpent in verse 14. And within this, we see a prophecy of a crucified Messiah. Look at this. Verse 14. So the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and all the wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the days of your life." Okay, and then here's verse 15. Here's what I want you to see. "I will put enmity between you and the woman." And God is saying, there's going to be this battle now between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. This cosmic battle that is set up between Satan and the forces of evil and the people of God, okay, that we see continuing today. And then look at what he says next at the end of verse 15. "He will crush your head, and you, serpent, will strike his heel." He's saying there's going to be this cosmic battle between the forces of evil and God's people. And he, that is, one of the offspring of the woman, will rise. A person born of a woman will come up, and he will crush your head, Satan, serpent. He will deliver the fatal blow, but you will strike his heel. He will be injured. His heel will be injured in the process. And we see there, already in Genesis 3, this picture of Christ, of our Messiah, of an offspring of the woman who comes and at the cross delivers this fatal blow to Satan. He takes away Satan's greatest weapon of accusation towards us, and yet he does it at the cost of something to himself, his own life. And it looks like a fatal blow to Jesus, but it's a fatal blow to Satan. And one day, Jesus will return and, of course, crush Satan under his feet once and for all. So already in Genesis 3, you have this picture of a champion who will come from among us, who will defeat our ancient foe, who is the foe behind all our foes every day. And yet we have a champion who is victorious over our foe. Okay? How we doing? Can I come out here? You guys doing okay? Yeah, okay, I'm going to walk around. I'm sensing there's a little bit of fatigue, so pretend I'm not here. Okay, let's go to Exodus chapter. I forgot my notes. Exodus 11. This is probably the most famous image of Christ. Verse 4, context is slavery in Egypt, right? And God has called Moses to bring the people out of Egypt. And Moses says this in verse 4, "This is what the Lord says, this is the 10th plague, about midnight I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn son of the slave girl who is at her handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle, okay? Firstborns will die." Chapter 12, verse 1, look at this picture. "The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, 'This month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household.'" This is what we just celebrated last week. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animal you will choose must be a year-old male without defect, and you may take him from the sheep or the goats." Okay? Take care of them. Verse 7. "Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs." Verse 12. "On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animal, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. And here it is. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. Okay, so this picture of a lamb, unblemished, who is slaughtered, and whose blood is put on the doorposts so that the wrath of God would pass over. And of course, Jesus may have pointed to this and said, I am ultimately, the Messiah is the ultimate Passover lamb whose blood is spilled on the cross so that the wrath of God would pass over his people and they might live. How about Numbers chapter 21? You might not think of this one either. Strange little story. Context, Israel's now in the wilderness. They should be in the promised land, but because of their unbelief, they're going to wander for 40 years. Verse 4, they traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom, but the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food. Then the Lord sent venomous snakes, strange story, among them. And they bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, we sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us. So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, make a snake and put it on a pole. Anyone who's bitten can look at the snake and live. So Moses made a bronze snake and put it on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, he lived. That's a really strange story. Okay, so the people are complaining, they're sinning, and God sends these snakes that to me is sort of this image of their sin and their unbelief. But the strange thing is that these things are killing them. It's a very strange thing. God says, take the thing that's killing them, take the source of the issue, and put it on a pole, and if they look at that, that will save them from the thing that's killing them. That's a strange kind of solution. I would think maybe, you know, take a lion and raise it up. And if you look to the lion, you can be freed from the snakes. But he says, no, take a snake and put it on a pole. You look to the snake, it'll free you from the snake bites. And Jesus in John 3, the sentence before the most famous sentence in all of Scripture, John 3:16, says this. Let me read it to you. Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. And what God does through Jesus is precisely what he did through the snakes. He takes Jesus, and the very thing that is tormenting us, our sin, he lays that on the cross, and Jesus becomes our sin. And yet, that action of our sin being laid on the cross, as we look to that, that is what brings us salvation and life. It's an amazing picture of the Messiah who becomes sin for his people. All right, one more. I'm going to skip one. Let's go to Isaiah 53, probably most famous. Here you have the Israelites, God letting them know that they're going to be carried off into exile, and yet that he will bring them back from exile, bring them back into the land. He's promising salvation. And this servant of the Lord starts popping up in the second half of Isaiah. This interesting figure who's going to be a servant. If you look at Isaiah 52, verse 13, see, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. That sounds good. But if you go to 53, verse 3, listen how this servant is described. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, and familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Verse 10, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Okay, that's hundreds of years before Christ comes. And I know that's very familiar, but that's just an amazing reality. This picture of a servant who's going to be lifted up and exalted, but through that is going to bear the sins of his people, and yet through that he will see life and his soul will be satisfied. And so Jesus could have taken him to any of those passages or many other. But do you see Christ? Are you beholding him through these pictures? We've got Jesus, the offspring of the woman who's our champion, our victor. We have Jesus, the Lamb, who is our perfect sacrifice. We have Jesus, the snake, who is raised up, who becomes sin for us. Jesus, the servant, the King, who comes as a servant of his people. Pretty amazing. And I think Jesus, I'm sure, drew on some of those and many others. So we see him through his word. And then finally today, we get to see him through one more image. It is the image of the breaking of bread that he gave us to celebrate regularly. And I'm looking at this bread. You know, I think of all the images, this is maybe the most basic image of all, the most fundamental, the most earthy, the most human. And we have a lamb, we have a king, we have a conqueror, we have a snake, but here we just get a piece of bread, something we eat every day. And it's a brilliant symbol he uses for us to see him. It tells us a lot about who we are as people, that we are hungry people, that we have longings, that we desire to be satisfied, and that we need the satisfaction of those longings. So it reminds us of who we are, these hungry people who need. It reminds us of who he is, that he is ultimately the satisfaction of our deepest hungers. Underneath all the things that we desire most in life is this desire for God, whether we know it or not. He is that satisfaction. And yet, as we know, he had to be broken. He had to be broken to become that satisfaction, to go to the cross and break his body to pay the penalty for our sins. It's a simple, beautiful picture. And I think it's a great picture of faith. Because what we do is we then take some of this bread and we eat it. And that's a picture of faith. It's saying yes to Jesus' sacrifice for us. But it tells us something about faith. And I've said this before. Faith is more than just giving intellectual assent to an idea. Yes, I believe that factually happened. Faith is taking it and receiving it for ourselves. Faith is saying, I believe it happened, and I'm going to feed on that. I'm going to find my satisfaction in what you did. I'm going to integrate that truth into my life. Popular saying goes, you are what you eat, right? Biologically, that is literally true. I take things from outside myself. I put them in my body. They get absorbed. The food out there actually becomes me. I am what I eat. And it's a picture of faith that Jesus is saying, I want you to take me, eat me so that I become part of your life. Feed on me, as he says. It's this great picture of faith. So we're going to celebrate communion today in just a second. Before we do that, on the floor, you've got a little 3x5 piece of paper, okay? Why don't you pick that up with a little pencil. Here's what we're going to do. We're about to share a meal. Jesus invites us to this meal regularly. So I want you to consider yourself at the meal right now. But before you usually have a conversation with the person you're eating with, right? So I want to invite you just to have just a minute or two of conversation with Jesus. And here's the question I want you to ask and answer. Our theme today has been seeing Jesus, seeing his glory. So here's my question to yourself, and you can write. How have you seen Jesus in your life lately? Or another way you can ask the question, how has Jesus been revealing himself to you lately? Okay, we're going to create some space for you just to have a conversation about that. How am I seeing Jesus? How is he revealing himself to me these days? And there's no right answer here. For some of you, maybe it's you're seeing him work in some of your friends' lives. You're seeing him in the lives around you, or he's using people to encourage you. Maybe he's using circumstances. Maybe you're seeing him in your reading of the Word. Maybe you're seeing him in nature. You're seeing part of his glory in nature. Whatever that is. Maybe you're here and you're like, I don't feel like I happen. I don't even know. I have no answer to that question. I don't feel like I'm experiencing Jesus or learning more about him. And this is a great time to have that conversation. Now, maybe you're here and you wouldn't even consider yourself a Christian. But you're here. And maybe the conversation is just, I'm here. If you're real, reveal yourself to me. Show yourself to me. And he can do that if he's real. So we're going to take a minute or two. This is where we're at. Consider yourself at the table with the Lord. He invites us to this table. And this is just table conversation with him. So just take a minute or two to have that conversation. Write down whatever you want to write down. And then we'll take the bread in a couple minutes.